CBS News, I'm Christopher Glenn. The Concorde suffers its first ever crash just after taking off from Paris.
The whole crowd, everyone sitting there went, oh my God, you know, I mean, it was flames. It wasn't a spark, it was flames.
All 109 people aboard the Air France supersonic jet and at least four people on the ground were killed when the plane came down in the town of Gonesse, just north of the airport. David Henderson, a private pilot who saw the SST take off, says there is no doubt that the plane was in trouble right from the start.
During the takeoff roll of the Concorde, just giant clouds of black sooty smoke were rising from the aircraft.
CBS News reporter Elaine Cobb joins us live now from Paris.
The passengers are believed to have been German nationals heading off to start a luxury cruise in the Atlantic off Ecuador. The plane had been chartered by a German tour company. The supersonic jet crashed into a field just beside a hotel, hitting a building attached to the hotel. The plane went up in a ball of flames. All 100 passengers and 9 crew were killed instantly, as well as 4 people on the ground. Fire services say there may be one survivor, someone who was on the ground rather than in the plane, but that is still unclear. Live in Paris, I'm Elaine Cobb, CBS News.
Again, an Air France Concorde, a charter flight filled with German tourists, crashes on takeoff from Paris. At least 113 people are dead. It's all over at Camp David. The peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians have collapsed. No agreement between the two sides on substantive issues. But President Clinton found some reason for optimism, even as he conceded failure in remarks at the White House. CBS News correspondent Mark Noller is with us live.
Though clearly disappointed that an agreement was not reached, the president is not giving up hope that a deal may yet be worked out between Israel and the Palestinians.
The overriding thing you need to know is that progress was made on all fronts, that significant progress was made on some of the core issues.
Speaking to reporters on his return from Camp David, the president said Barak and Arafat should go home, get some sleep, and then try again to resolve their differences, if possible before their September 13th target date. Live at the White House, I'm Mark Noller, CBS News.
Dick Cheney has arrived at the Texas governor's mansion in Austin. In a couple of hours, he'll appear at a rally with George W. Bush, who will make it official. He's tapped the former defense secretary to be his running mate on the Republican ticket in the November elections. Republican strategist David Keene, a longtime friend of Cheney, says there's no doubt he's qualified to assume the presidency should the need arise, but he also notes...
The only real downside, and it isn't much of a downside given what a vice president can and can't do for a candidate, is that he's not an extremely exciting candidate.
On Wall Street right now, the Dow Industrials ahead by 25 points. The NASDAQ Composite is up 23.5. This is CBS News.
Hi, I'm Tom Bosley, and if you've ever wondered what it's like buying term life insurance over the phone from SelectQuote, you're about to find out.
Thank you for calling SelectQuote. This is Brenda Dunn. How can I help you?
Brenda, what if someone says they can get me a lower price on term life insurance than SelectQuote?
Then I'd be quite surprised. We represent the pick of over 1,500 top-rated life insurance companies who offer the most competitive rates.
Well, give us an example of those prices.
Okay, I'm 32 years old. Through SelectQuote, I can buy a $250,000 policy and lock in the rate for a 10-year period for under $9 a month.
Thanks, Brenda. Isn't it time you called SelectQuote? Call 1-800-772-8600, and you can buy your policy right over the phone. 1-800-772-8600. Or visit our website, selectquote.com.
Example is Banner Preferred Plus Select Term 10-Year Policy Number RT99, underwritten by Banner Life Insurance Company, Rockville, Maryland. Forms and plan provisions may vary by state. Plan not available in all states.
A big day in orbit. The Russian-built service module Zvezda will dock with the International Space Station. CBS News space consultant Bill Harwood tells us it's more than just another step in the construction of the station.
It's absolutely critical. It's 2 years behind schedule, and it's held up all the modules NASA's waiting to launch. There are 5 shuttle payloads sitting down here at the Kennedy Space Center waiting to go. Once this module gets in space, those flights will begin. And more important, the first full-time crew will blast off on a Soyuz rocket in late October, early November. And once they're aboard, there'll be astronauts and cosmonauts aboard the station full-time for the foreseeable future. So it's a critical mission for NASA.
CBS News space consultant Bill Harwood. And repeating the top stories this hour, first crash ever of a Concorde supersonic jet outside Paris. 113 known dead, at least 4 of the victims on the ground. President Clinton concedes failure of Camp David Middle East peace talks, but says Israel and the Palestinians made real headway toward a future settlement. I'm Christopher Glenn.
CBS News Update. I'm John Harchie. The first ever crash of a supersonic Concorde jet has killed all 109 on board and at least four people on the ground. The Air France charter headed for New York crashed about 2.5 hours ago while taking off from Paris. CBS News reporter Elaine Cobb is with us live from Paris. Elaine, where exactly did the plane go down?
The supersonic jet crashed in the town of Gonesse, which is just southwest of Charles de Gaulle Airport, from where it had taken off a mere 2 minutes before. Now, the jet crashed into a hotel building and then came to rest in the field nearby, immediately went up in a ball of flames. There's still a lot of smoke coming from the wreckage of the plane. Fire services say it's unlikely that anyone could have survived that, and they must all have died instantly.
Aviation consultant Richard Ditchy says reports of a fire in one engine probably don't tell the whole story.
I suspect that something other than a simple engine failure has taken place here.
I'm John Hartshee.
This is Peter Mayer in Washington. President Clinton is trying to put the pieces back together following the collapse of the Camp David summit.
While we did not get an agreement here, significant progress was made on the core issues.
But the two sides could not come to terms on the toughest issue of all, the future of Jerusalem. And speaking just a few minutes ago in Frederick, Maryland, Israeli Prime Minister Barak said Palestinian leader Arafat's stand on the holy city blocked an agreement.
Unfortunately, Arafat somehow hesitated to take the historic decisions that were needed.
But President Clinton still believes the diplomatic gaps can be bridged.
If we'll keep at it, I still think we can get it done.
The U.S. and the Israeli and Palestinian delegations have issued a statement following the collapse of the Camp David summit. They promise to continue all efforts to reach an agreement on all of the issues as soon as possible. CBS News Update. I'm Peter Mayer.
It's Tuesday, July 25th. I'm Tony Khan. Today, a fatal Concorde crash in Paris.
We heard a thunderous roar, which I turned to look what it was. All we could see, first of all, was a big cloud of black smoke.
Also, after 15 days, the Camp David summit is over, but the Middle East peace process is not. Plus, who wants to be an Indian millionaire? First, this news.
From BBC News in London, I'm Gregor Craigie for The World. A Concorde supersonic passenger plane bound for New York has crashed near Paris, killing 113 people. None of the passengers and crew on board the flight survived, and another four people were killed on the ground. An eyewitness describes what he saw as the aircraft took off from Charles de Gaulle Airport.
All we could see, first of all, was a big cloud of black smoke to our left on the runway, and then a big ball of flame, and then the plane seemed to take off. It then turned and seemed to flip over, still well on fire, went out of view, and then there was just a big plume of smoke.
Most of those on board the aircraft are believed to have been German, though some reports say two Danes and one U.S. citizen were also on board. The Air France plane was making a special charter flight to New York. The BBC's Hugh Schofield is at the crash scene.
Two deep ruts have been gouged from the wheat field, which end when the ground suddenly turns black. And over an area the size of a football pitch, firemen pick their way through the charred debris, some putting out the last fires, still burning 3 hours after the crash, others placing white and orange bollards to mark the location of corpses. At one end stand the burned-out remains of the small hotel into which the Concorde crashed. Among the formless blackened shapes that are strewn over the area, only a few recognizable pieces of the aeroplane remain, lumps of yellow foam, strips of metal, and a section of white fuselage bearing part of the Air France logo.
Hugh Schofield reporting. The Middle East peace talks at Camp David have broken up with no agreement. President Clinton says both sides still want to reach a settlement this year, but Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak is blaming Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat for the failure of the talks. Richard Lister reports.
This is a very serious setback for the Middle East peace process, but speaking from the White House, Mr. Clinton tried to make the best of it.
At the end of this summit, I am fully aware of the deep disappointment that will be felt on both sides. But it was essential for Israelis and Palestinians finally to begin to deal with the toughest decisions in the peace process. Only they can make those decisions, and they both pledged to make them, I say again, by mid-September.
Now that this summit has broken down, the recriminations have begun. Speaking near Camp David, Ehud Barak said the Palestinian position on Jerusalem had blocked agreement. The Palestinians say the Israelis refused to compromise, but Mr. Clinton appeared to reject that, saying Mr. Barak had taken some courageous steps and moved further from his initial negotiating stance than the Palestinians. Richard Lister, BBC News, outside Camp David.
Once again, updating our top story, a Concorde supersonic jet bound for New York has crashed near Paris, killing 113 people. Chile's Supreme Court has begun deliberations on whether former military ruler Augusto Pinochet can be stripped of his immunity from prosecution. If the court lifts his immunity as a senator, Pinochet could face a trial for human rights abuses. James Reynolds reports.
The 20 members of the Supreme Court must decide on two issues. Firstly, they must decide whether to order medical tests to be carried out on Augusto Pinochet to determine whether he is fit to stand trial. And secondly, they must decide whether there is enough evidence to warrant a full trial. Last month, the lower court voted that there was sufficient evidence against Augusto Pinochet to lift his immunity from prosecution. Lawyers seeking the general's prosecution say they are confident that the Supreme Court will uphold the lower court's decision. Members of Augusto Pinochet's legal team say they are optimistic that the ruling will be overturned. James Reynolds, BBC News.
A seabird thought to have become extinct in the 1930s has been rediscovered in the South China Sea. Six pairs of Chinese crested terns have been spotted rearing chicks on a tiny islet. The BBC's Toby Murcott reports.
The last confirmed sighting of the Chinese crested tern was in 1937. But after more than 60 years classified as extinct, the species has returned from the dead. The birds were spotted by a tourist who sent photographs to the Wild Bird Federation Taiwan. The excited ornithologists carefully examined the photos and confirmed that the tern is alive and well. With the rate of extinction estimated at around 100 species per day, conservationists are taking at least a glimmer of hope from this one species still hanging on to life. Just.
Toby Murcott reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones is up 34 points, and the Nasdaq is also up by 29. BBC News for the World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with the support of Merck, pharmaceutical research dedicated to preventing disease and improving health. Merck, committed to bringing out the best in medicine, and by the Medtronic Foundation. Medtronic, when life depends on medical technology.
This is The World. I'm Tony Khan. Two stories dominate today's news. At the White House, President Clinton announced the end of the Camp David summit, an end that came without agreement on a Middle East peace accord. More on that in a few minutes. But we first turn to Paris, where an Air France Concorde jet crashed today, right after takeoff from Charles de Gaulle Airport. 109 people were on board, mostly German tourists and 9 crew members. All are feared dead, along with several people on the ground.
I turned to look what it was. All we could see, first of all, was a big cloud of black smoke.
Dave Ingram witnessed the crash from Charles de Gaulle Airport. He says that after the smoke, he saw a huge fireball as the plane appeared to be struggling to gain altitude.
It then turned and seemed to flip over because I suppose we are looking, as the crow flies, about a mile and a half by that time. Seemed to flip over, still well on fire. Went out of view, and then there was just a big plume of smoke going up into the clouds.
The Concorde is known as the airline industry's luxury liner, catering to the very rich. A ticket for this trip might have cost up to $9,000, and the supersonic jet was able to fly at speeds of 1,300 miles per hour. Until today, the Concorde had an excellent safety record. Today's is the first accident in more than 20 years and the only one with casualties. We spoke to Gregory Gerejean, the town of Gonesse, France. Gerejean is the manager of the public golf club in Gonesse, located about a mile from the site of the accident. Gerejean watched and heard today's Concorde take off, and he immediately noticed something was wrong.
On a eu le sentiment que les moteurs
The noise, he said, gave us the impression that the motors were on, off, on, off, and it made a peculiar noise. We saw the plane first explode in flight and then crash. We saw the Concorde go up in flames. Its rear left engine was on fire, and then it quickly crashed on an area that's mostly bare except for two little hotels. Jean says the plane's engines appear to be stalling and starting again and again. Then he says the plane exploded in the air, fell to the ground in an area where, as we mentioned before, there were a few buildings, but two small hotels. The Concorde hit one of those hotels. Gregory Jean says it could have been much worse. Again, he says, I think that now we still have trouble to realize what happened, though we are saddened by the event. But the feeling that prevails here, I think, is that the plane did not crash on houses or in the downtown area, but in a fairly isolated area on a hotel that didn't have that many people in it. So we feel that we've avoided something even more catastrophic. Chris Yates, meanwhile, is the aviation safety and security editor for Jane's Transport Publications in Britain. He says that despite the early clues, it's still too early to tell what happened to the Air France Concorde that crashed today.
It does seem from those eyewitness statements that there was a fire in one of the engines, and what the cause of that fire was at this stage is uncertain. Certainly, I would think that it would be some sort of mechanical failure, catastrophic mechanical failure, but what the cause of that mechanical failure is, I just don't know.
This comes a day after British Airways grounded one of the Concorde jets, not this one, but another, after some small cracks were discovered in a number of the planes, I gather. Could there be any connection between that and what happened to Flight 4590 today?
I think we have to make a very clear differentiation here that we're talking about two different airlines. The aircraft that crashed today did belong to Air France. British Airways had the problem with cracks in the wings yesterday. I doubt very much at this stage that the two are in actual fact linked. It would seem that we're talking a whole different ballgame with regard to the accident in Paris.
And the safety record of the Concorde prior to this has been also really exemplary, hasn't it?
Exemplary is about the right word. The only other incident of note with a Concorde since 1969, when the aircraft first flew, was in 1979, when a Concorde landing burst all its tires. That resulted in a design modification. And since then, the aircraft has and the airframe has never suffered any other problem.
I've heard a statement that prior to this accident, the airline was saying that they had rated this particular airplane to be safe to be flown until the year 2007. My question is, how can one make an assumption like that?
That sort of judgment is based upon the prior operating history of an aircraft type. It is also based on a lot of engineering data, scientific evidence and such like. Investigation into the airframe and how it's withstanding the rigors of being in the air almost on a daily basis. Based on those findings, then the authorities make a decision as to how long the airframe has, what sort of lifespan the airframe has.
Chris, in terms of determining what might have been the cause of this crash, what happens next?
Certainly the French aviation authorities will be on scene as we speak, and they will start to look for any evidence pointing to the cause. Obviously, the flight data recorders will be the key in that inquiry, but equally, the investigators will look for even small pieces of wreckage because they could have telltale signs on them that would give the investigators some clue as to what actually happened.
At this point, will the airline, Chris, be under any kind of pressure, either from a scientific or a political point of view, to cease operations or to call these planes out of service until some determination has been made about what caused the crash?
It is entirely possible that the safety authorities will instruct Air France to check the remainder of the aircraft in its fleet. They may even ground those aircraft as a temporary safety measure until such a time as a cause for this crash has been determined. That, of course, is an issue for the French authorities and the French authorities alone.
Characterize for me, if you can, Chris, the kind of thinking that happens at this particular point where you have a crash with an airline that has had, as you say, such an exemplary record. When something like this happens, what are the kinds of thoughts that go through your mind?
It's just such a shock. Initially, a sense of horror I felt when notified of this an hour and a half ago. And beyond that, we have to start asking questions as to whether the airframe can continue, given its age, to withstand the rigors that it has to withstand in daily service.
We've just heard, by the way, Chris, that BA has suspended the Concorde flights for tonight, I gather. Any comment on that?
Perhaps a wise precaution at this stage, and no other reason than passenger peace of mind.
Chris Yates is the aviation safety and security editor for Jane's Transport. He was speaking to us from Manchester, England. Thanks an awful lot, Chris.
A pleasure.
Today's other top story comes from Camp David, Maryland, where 2 weeks of Middle East summitry ended today without an agreement. President Clinton said that despite the intensive discussions with Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, no deal would be possible. As he put it, they couldn't get there. We'll hear the president's comments and reactions from the Middle East later in the program, but first we go to Camp David, where the BBC's Richard Lister says the summit was not a complete failure.
There was no agreement, it seems, on the substantive issues, although President Clinton made quite clear that quite a lot of progress had been made in some areas. He said that he'd actually been surprised by how much progress had been made. The problem is that under the format of these talks, nothing is agreed until everything agreed.
In a sense, although one is always going to end up oversimplifying this, regrettably, the answer is the answer to why the talks broke the word Jerusalem and everything that goes with it.
President Clinton certainly confirmed that that was the most difficult issue. And we've been hearing from sources close to the delegations from both Israel and the Palestinian side that really since Monday of last week, the whole talks process has been deadlocked over this one issue of Jerusalem. Basically, the Palestinians want full sovereignty over the eastern part of the city, which they will then use as the capital of a Palestinian state. The Israeli red line, so-called, when Ehud Barak arrived here, was that the city of Jerusalem would never be divided and Israel would never relinquish sovereignty over any part of it. Now, President Clinton seemed to indicate that the Israeli position had in fact changed. He said that Mr. Barak had moved much further from his initial stance than Mr. Arafat over the course of these talks. He didn't give anything away about how far that has changed, but it does seem that some progress was made on Jerusalem, but it wasn't enough for the Palestinians.
Should we be reading anything more into that? That the fact, indeed, as you say, that the president seemed to be giving Ehud Barak more credit for having gone farther than he did Yasser Arafat.
Well, he sort of caught himself a little bit because when he was answering questions at the White House about why this had broken down, it was quite clear that he was praising Mr. Barak for having made courageous decisions, for having made bold decisions, and for having moved further than the Palestinians. When asked, look, are you blaming the Palestinians on this? He was very quick to say, no, I'm not blaming anybody. I'm simply praising Mr. Barak. The clear inference was, though, that we all drew was that it was the Israelis who'd moved a bit further than the Palestinians this time around. And Mr. Clinton was somewhat disappointed that there hadn't been a deal. Now, that said, it's really very difficult to say at this stage whether the positions that have been set out over the course of these talks were the absolute final positions. It could simply be that both sides need to be making the point at this stage, we're not going any further, and it will take more than just 2 weeks of talks to settle the most divisive issues in the Middle East.
Well, what about the U.S. continued involvement in this? Certainly it's heavily invested already, as is the president personally. Any idea of what the continued involvement of the U.S. might be in this?
Well, in the trilateral statement agreed by the Palestinians, Israelis and the United States, they all agreed that the United States would continue its role in this peace process. It would continue to try and reach agreement. And Mr. Clinton said that both sides had agreed to try and keep pushing for an agreement by mid-September, which is the deadline they've given themselves. So it's expected that the U.S. will send a senior envoy, perhaps Dennis Ross, the president's Middle East envoy, back to the Middle East to try and see where they go from here.
How are both sides at this point characterizing the failure to reach agreement?
Well, Mr. Barak had a news conference shortly after the breakup of talks just a little way outside Camp David, in which he was very clear that the reason these talks have broken down was because, as he put it, Mr. Arafat refused to take the historic decisions necessary to conclude a deal. And he said it was the Palestinian position on Jerusalem that had scuppered these talks. Mr. Arafat has not made any statements about it, but Palestinian officials have made clear for their part that the Israelis had refused to compromise. And it does seem that Jerusalem was the sticking point, and it does also seem that the Palestinians were not prepared to accept what the Israelis were offering. For their part, the Israelis weren't going to accept the demands that the Palestinians were making.
In a word, if that's possible, Richard, how would you characterize the mood there now? Exhausted? Sad? Relieved?
Certainly, the delegations will be exhausted. President Clinton is trying to remain upbeat about this, and I think one thing that he pointed out that we really should keep in mind is that these past 2 weeks have seen more intensive negotiation about issues which are really the key to solving this whole question of peace in the Middle East than ever before. The issues like Jerusalem have never been discussed in as much depth as they have been in the past 2 weeks, and the political landscape really has been shifted by the discussions which have taken place here.
Richard, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The BBC's Richard Lister, just outside Camp David, Maryland. Just ahead, digging for the dirt on Saddam Hussein on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with the support of Merck, dedicated to the needs of society through pharmaceutical research and consumer education to improve the quality of life. Merck, committed to bringing out the best in medicine.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on NPR's All Things Considered, you'll hear all the news and features we've collected for the program. And in between the talk, you'll hear bits of music. Marika Partridge and Bob Boylan choose them. Sometimes they're topical, sometimes new music. If you wonder what you just heard, check the website. Listen for all the bits and pieces later today on NPR's All Things Considered.
All Things Considered, today from 4 to 7 p.m. on 89.9 KCRW.
Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worries.
Fresh Air's encore presentation of our series on American popular song continues next Monday with our tribute to lyricist Dorothy Fields. Fields co-wrote On the Sunny Side of the Street, I Can't Give You Anything But Love, and I'm in the Mood for Love. I'm Terry Gross. Join us.
Life can be.
Tune in for Fresh Air weekday afternoons from 3 to 4 on 89.9 KCRW.
This is The World. I'm Tony Khan. A London-based organization supported by the British government and funded by the United States said today it has the goods on several top Iraqi officials. The group, named Indict, claims it's gathered enough evidence to support the prosecution of President Saddam Hussein and his underlings for war crimes. The accusations stem from Iraq's 8-year conflict with Iran, its occupation of Kuwait from 1990 to 91, and the government's use of torture within Iraq. From London, The World's Andrew North has details.
Indict says it's compiled war crimes charges against at least 5 senior Iraqi officials in the hope of encouraging the creation of a UN war crimes tribunal for Iraq. The details have been kept secret, but the suspects include the Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, his 2 sons, and Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz. Anne Cluid, a British Member of Parliament who set up Indict 3 years ago, says the evidence against the Iraqi officials would stand up in any court. But she admits there's still no court to hear such charges, and that Western governments show no sign of establishing one.
As yet, we don't know whether that political will exists in various other countries in Europe, indeed in the United Kingdom itself. So this is a test, really, of the resolve of countries to do what they say they want to do, and that is to bring Iraqi war criminals to justice.
The Clinton administration, which provides most of the funding for Indict, says it wants to see Saddam Hussein and his associates held accountable for their actions. But it too has not committed itself to setting up a special court for Iraq. And the US government has also opposed calls for a universal war crimes court. However, David Sheffer, the US ambassador for war crimes issues, says that Indict's files will be shown to various European governments that have allowed senior Iraqi officials to enter their territory. And Ambassador Sheffer says they'll be asked these questions.
What is your reaction going to be to the presence of that individual in your territory? Do you deny him access? Do you permit him access and arrest him? Do you permit him to operate freely on your territory?
In fact, Iraqi dissident groups almost succeeded in securing the arrest of a senior Iraqi official last year when he was visiting Austria. The Austrian prosecutor was drawing up an arrest warrant, but the Iraqi official got word of the plans and fled the country. Indict's dossier is unlikely to lead to the arrest of Saddam Hussein, who never leaves Iraq. Even so, says Iraqi analyst Ghassan Atiyah, the Iraqi leader will suffer real consequences from the evidence Indict has compiled.
The fact that he is going to be chased internationally, this will put those countries who are cooperating with the Baghdadi regime or thinking of rehabilitating him, think it twice, because such a measure will no doubt alienate or anger the American administration.
He doubts that Saddam Hussein will ever be prosecuted for war crimes. But he says the fact that an organization is at least drawing up a charge sheet will give hope to many Iraqis who've suffered under Saddam Hussein's regime. For The World, this is Andrew North in London.
Since he swept a victory earlier this month, Mexican President-elect Vicente Fox has vowed to crack down on drug trafficking, root out corruption, and improve the lot of ordinary people. Fox wants to give Mexicans fewer reasons to emigrate to the United States, but he also wants the United States to reverse its border policy of recent years, which has seen more fencing and far more patrols along the U.S.-Mexico line. The fortification of the border is especially good business for professional smugglers who sell their expertise in jumping the border. The World's Frank Contreras reports.
There are many ways for would-be immigrants to find smugglers to take them across to the United States. For many, it begins with a plane ride north to border country. This man, Javier, is on his way to try his luck jumping the border. He says his brother, who is now working illegally in California, sent him the money for the plane ticket. The plane is headed to northern Mexico, south of Arizona, but Javier doesn't want to cross the border there. He says he recently saw on TV that the U.S. Border Patrol is beefing up that part of the border. So Javier plans to take a bus with his sister-in-law and her two kids to the Texas border. That's where he says he'll hook up with a smuggler known as a coyote. The coyote's fee, says Javier, will be around $800. The INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, estimates that a full 95% of illegal crossings from Mexico are coordinated by smugglers. People smuggling has become especially popular since U.S. authorities started fencing and patrolling much more of the 2,000-mile border in the early 1990s. Yo también soy traficante, pero no de hierba mala. This popular Mexican song describes how easy it is to jump the border courtesy of a smuggler who's ready to sell you a fake passport with no trouble. If you want to get to the U.S., the song goes, you need to know this code. Just ask for the person who mocks the Border Patrol, and for the right price, a smuggler will fix it. The price can run to $1,800, but it's increasingly being paid with human lives, says Johnny Williams of the INS.
Make no mistake, as we head into this increasingly dangerous time in the deserts, these efforts of these vermin smugglers will continue. The alien smugglers' greed, their reckless disregard for the lives of others, makes them our public enemy number one.
The smugglers can be quite imaginative. In one elaborate scheme, coyotes dressed their clients in Lycra biking clothes and helmets. The would-be immigrants each paid $1,500 to cross into Texas on 10-speed bikes, where they would pose as American cycling teams. But last week, the Border Patrol caught up with a group of them, putting an end to that piece of border theater. Under U.S. law, if someone dies while crossing the border with a smuggler, the smuggler could face life in prison. Mexican authorities, too, are serious about clamping down on coyotes, according to Miguel Valdez, the Mexican consul in Douglas, Arizona.
In Mexico, the penalties for this sort of illegal activity are more severe right now. The local police and the state judiciary police of all the states that borders the United States are working quite closely trying to prevent the existence of these mafias of coyotes. And I believe that the same sort of effort is being done in the United States, because we do recognize that the common enemy that prey on the migrant is actually El Coyote.
Mexico has a special police force whose job is to protect would-be illegal immigrants from the smugglers. But Ricardo Garcia Cervantes, who chairs Mexico's Senate Committee on Border Affairs, says many officers in this police force are actually more protective of the smugglers.
Finalmente, ante cualquier riesgo, hasta los abandonan en contenedores, en trailers, en...
Cervantes says smugglers, who often abandon their clients in deserts, are able to do their illegal work because they know they can bribe their way out of trouble. Mexican President-elect Vicente Fox says he wants to root out corruption in the country's law enforcement and judicial systems, much as outgoing President Ernesto Zedillo said he wanted to do at the beginning of his term. But even if border smugglers are held more accountable in Mexico, their services are likely to remain popular, so long as poor Mexicans are willing to risk crossing illegally into the United States. For the world, this is Frank Contreras.
And this is PRI.
Local broadcast time is made possible in part by Pacific Bell, providing network integration solutions for business data, video, and voice needs.
The heat is on. What does it mean for the price of electricity and the supply? Today on Which Way LA, is there enough power for deregulation? That's Which Way LA today at 1, repeated at 7 on 89.9 KCRW.
What's your idea of a retirement paradise? American retirees who once chose conventional settings in Florida and Arizona are now turning to the open arms of Thailand.
I live in a house that's 3,500 square feet. I built it on the side of a mountain. I'm not going to tell you how much I paid for it, but it's a lot cheaper than it would be in America, okay?
I'm David Brancaccio. Hear how one country is finding gold in America's golden years later on Marketplace from PRI.
That's Marketplace today at 2 o'clock, right after Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
From BBC News in London, I'm Gregor Craigie for The World. A Concorde aircraft bound for New York has crashed soon after taking off from Paris, killing 113 people. Officials said one engine was on fire as the supersonic passenger plane took off. Eyewitnesses speak of a huge fireball as the aircraft hit the ground. British businessman Jamie Ritchie saw what happened.
We overheard a very loud roaring noise. We saw very briefly the tail of Concorde. We saw something fall from the tail into an open field that was on fire. And then the plane crashed and there is a large plume of smoke some 1,000 feet high.
In Washington, President Clinton has expressed sorrow at the news.
I just heard the news of the crash of the Concorde outside Paris, and I wanted to extend the deepest condolences of the American people to the families of those who were lost.
Air France says the crash was due to engine trouble and not to tiny cracks found recently on the wings of some Concordes. The flight had been chartered by a German tour operator, and most of the victims are believed to have been Germans. The Camp David peace summit has ended without agreement, and both sides are accusing each other for the failure. President Clinton has acknowledged the talks foundered on the issue of Jerusalem. He's urging both leaders to return home and reflect.
Israelis and Palestinians are destined to live side by side, destined to have a common future. They have to decide what kind of future it will be.
Washington will send Mideast envoy Dennis Ross to the region soon to see if talks can be restarted. But for now, both Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat will be returning to face critical audiences at home. John Lyne reports from Jerusalem.
Both the Israelis and Palestinians have been quick to blame each other for the failure of the summit. Palestinian spokeswoman Hanan Ashrawi accused the Israelis of trying to browbeat the Palestinians into accepting a deal. Mr. Barak will return to vocal opposition for concessions he is reported to have made at Camp David. By contrast, Yasser Arafat has already won support in the Arab world for his apparent refusal to make further compromises over the issue of Jerusalem. But senior figures in the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas have reiterated their call for a return to violence. The fear now will be of rising tension as the Palestinian deadline for declaring a state approaches on September the 13th. John Lyne, BBC, Jerusalem.
Finally, it's official. George W. Bush has formally acknowledged his choice of Dick Cheney as vice presidential running mate. Appearing with Cheney at his side at a rally in Austin, Texas, Bush said, "I believe you're looking at the next vice president of the United States." BBC News for the World, I'm Gregor Craigie.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with the support of Merck, pharmaceutical research dedicated to preventing disease and improving health. Merck, committed to bringing out the best in medicine.
This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH in Boston. I'm Tony Khan.
After 14 days of intensive negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, I have concluded with regret that they will not be able to reach an agreement at this time.
And so President Clinton today announced the end of the Camp David summit. Mr. Clinton had called Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to the Maryland retreat to deal with the so-called final status issues, such as the borders of a future Palestinian state, the fate of 3 million Palestinian refugees, and what would happen to the Jewish settlers on the West Bank and Gaza. Despite the failure to reach a full agreement, President Clinton said the leaders had moved the peace process forward.
Now, at Camp David, both sides engaged in comprehensive discussions that were really unprecedented because they dealt with the most sensitive issues dividing them. Profound and complex questions that long had been considered off limits. Under the operating rules that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed, they are, of course, not bound by any proposal discussed at the summit. However, while we did not get an agreement here, significant progress was made on the core issues.
Mr. Clinton acknowledged that the key stumbling block was Jerusalem. Israel entered the summit contending that it would have to retain control over the entire city. The Palestinians were insisting on sovereignty over East Jerusalem. During the talks, Israel reportedly agreed to permit Palestinian control over some Arab neighborhoods in the old city. But the Palestinian delegation is said to have found that proposal a non-starter. President Clinton said today that Prime Minister Barak and Chairman Arafat are committed to keeping the peace process going, that they would now return home and reflect. The president expressed the hope that a deal could still be reached by the mid-September deadline that the two sides have set for themselves. Arafat has threatened to declare an independent Palestinian state on September the 13th. But President Clinton today cautioned against any provocative actions by any Middle East leaders.
At the end of this summit, I am fully aware of the deep disappointment that will be felt on both sides. But it was essential for Israelis and Palestinians finally to begin to deal with the toughest decisions in the peace process. Only they can make those decisions, and they both pledged to make them, I say again, by mid-September. Now it's essential that they not lose hope, that they keep working for peace, they avoid any unilateral actions that would only make the hard task ahead more difficult. The statement the leaders that have made today is encouraging in that regard.
Although President Clinton insisted he was not trying to put a sunny gloss on the outcome of the summit, he was clearly trying to keep the tone upbeat. But back in the Middle East, the blame game has begun. The World's Richard Myron is in Jerusalem. Richard, what are the two sides saying to their separate constituencies about the breakdown and who caused it?
Well, naturally enough, they're blaming each other. Ehud Barak, the Israeli prime minister, said that the Palestinians couldn't come to a historical decision. They weren't prepared to go far enough to reach an agreement. And he blamed Yasser Arafat, especially on the question of Jerusalem. The Palestinians have also, naturally enough, been blaming the Israelis, who said that the Israelis wouldn't make sufficient concessions on Jerusalem and would only give them limited authority over certain areas, and that they were in defiance of international law on this question. So there is a sense now they're appealing to their publics and to the international community at large to say, we did all we could, we went as far as we could, but the other side was to blame.
Richard, it seemed that Clinton was, in a sense, congratulating Barak a bit more than he was Arafat for having gone the longer distance. Does that in any way cause more of a problem for Barak in terms of his own constituency when he goes back? After all, he has some fences, I suppose, he has to mend.
I think it's going to strengthen him vis-a-vis his constituency. I was speaking to somebody who used to or advised the Prime Minister just before he left for Camp David, and he said he felt that this would be seen as a validation for Barak by the peace camp as such, by the left wing in Israel, that he'd gone and he'd tried to win over the other side and he'd gone as far as he could to make an agreement.
What about from Arafat's point of view? He had his own critics back at home. Has this solidified the support for him that there is and maybe even made it stronger?
I think it has certainly confirmed among the majority of Palestinians who never really believed there were chances for a real peace agreement which would deliver them their rights. It's confirmed their beliefs, and Arafat will say that, you know, he stood up for them. He was their man fighting their corner in Camp David. He wasn't going to compromise the Israelis, the Americans, or anybody. So this will back up his support. Hamas will say, the Islamic opposition, that it backs up their support, that you can't get an agreement through negotiations with the Israelis. But I think certainly in the short term, it is going to shore up support for Yasser Arafat.
All this having been said, Richard, what is the mood there now? Are people really more tense since peace has not come and since peace could only be bought basically by buying the whole package or none at all?
I think there is tension. There's great fear that there could be violence now. Both the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis have warned that there is the possibility of violence, both blaming each other for the possibility that could break out. In a situation where you do have a vacuum, and that's what exists at the moment, you have a clock ticking where Palestinians have said that they will declare statehood on September the 13th, there is a danger that all sorts of things could happen, that extremists could step in and could really create or add to what is really quite a dangerous situation. So there is clearly concern here, but at the same time, there is hope. An Israeli commentator speaking to me earlier said that the process is not dead. And the Palestinians also have said the process is not dead. There is still more work that can be done. But from both sides, and maybe they've learned to understand the stand of each other a bit more. We do have time yet, but as I say, the dangers that there could be violence are very real.
Well, let me ask you to talk just a little bit more about that. On the psychic front, how has this process at Camp David changed the atmosphere back at home? People say that maybe the most significant thing was that this conference proved that both sides could indeed talk about the unsolvable problems, and even if they couldn't solve them, at least not be wiped out for having tried.
Well, this is it. Barak really broke many taboos to the Israeli public by putting Jerusalem on the negotiating table. Before, there was no sense that this could go on the negotiating table. And having broken the taboo, maybe it does allow for the possibility that this can be broached, some agreement can be broached in the future. And maybe the indications that the Palestinians or the Israelis are willing to do a deal on this, and they may also feel they have the ability to compromise. It may be an edging towards an agreement. It may not be as pessimistic as it seems to be at first glance.
Now that these two men are going home, Richard, can we expect to see both of them appearing together on any talk show?
I don't think so. I think that's some way off. There's no love lost between these two men. They may have begun to appreciate the other's point of view, but they didn't come out friends. This is the point. You don't have to be friends in order necessarily to make peace. You have to have an understanding of the needs of the other side. And maybe those optimists in the region, there may be fewer of them tonight, will gain some heart from that, and they do understand each other's point of views, and that gives a realistic ground for going forward. But of course the pessimists will answer, well, the two men looked each other in the eye, stated what they believed in, and they just couldn't make an agreement on that basis. And maybe peace will appear in a few months, but I think there's a lot of work to be done before that happens.
The world's Richard Myron speaking to us from Jerusalem. Set your sights on Eastern Europe for today's GeoQuiz. We're in southern Poland, searching for a beautiful old city. This place began its existence around 700 AD as a fort along the Vistula River. And by the 12th century, it had become the capital of Poland. But in 1241, Tatar invaders, originally from Mongolia, sacked the city. One of our mystery destination's best-known traditions, in fact, was born of that experience. To this day, every hour, a trumpet player sounds a five-note call from the high tower of St. Mary's Church. That echoes the bugle call of a 13th-century watchman who spied the Tatar enemy advancing on the city. After five warning blasts from the watchman, a Tatar arrow pierced his throat. Today, after the mothballing of the communist era, this city is again attracting tourists from all over the world. So, where are we? Well, we'll have the answer in just a few blasts of the trumpet. Despite talk that it would be a flash in the Nielsen's ratings pan, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire remains by far the most watched show on American TV. Actually, not just on American TV. The quiz show originated in Britain, where it's still a hit, and it's recently taken India by storm. There, the top prize is 10 million rupees, which is about $220,000. And the host is a film star. From India's entertainment capital, Bombay, we have this report from the BBC's Jill McGivering.
Four evenings a week, streets across the country fall silent as millions of households cluster around their TVs to watch.
Hello, welcome, good evening, or namaskar.
India's version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is now in its fourth week here and getting extraordinary ratings. One survey said 40% of all the people who could watch the programme were watching it. It's simply the talk of the town.
It's good, it's a copy, but I guess to start you need to copy.
First time in India. The questions are sometimes very easy, but sometimes they are very dicey and it adds more to the tension, the way he speaks. Are you sure, pakka, lock in and all that stuff. It adds more to the tension, it's a good thing.
One major appeal is the show's host. Amitabh Bachchan is one of India's most famous faces, and this is his first venture into television. Amitabh Bachchan is better known singing and dancing his way through decades of Hindi blockbusters. He's one of India's film legends, who scorned television in the past, but not anymore.
It's been a nightmare for me in television.
The transition clearly hasn't been easy.
As a film artist, I'd say it's 100 times more tougher on television. And this whole business of, you know, looking into a lens and talking to it as though there are millions of people watching you is a very difficult task. So I have a great admiration suddenly for a lot of people who do television.
Indian TV channel Star Plus had to pay a huge amount by Indian standards for the format. Now it seems the gamble has paid off. Samir Nair, head of programming at Star Plus, says the show is breaking new ground for India.
On the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, Kaun Banega Crorepati, it's pure money and it's high stakes, big loss, big win. On most of the other game shows, it's really gift vouchers, gift hampers, you know, small holidays. I mean, it's pretty regular kind of stuff.
A. Ganga. B. Yamuna. C. Satluj. Or D. Gomti.
B. Yamuna.
B. Yamuna. Okay. B. Yamuna ko lock kiya jaye. Sahi jawab, 2000 rupees.
As in the United States, some people have criticized the questions of the local version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire for being too easy, for patronizing the audience. Others say it's encouraging a money-grabbing mentality. Last time India saw ratings like these was 10 years ago, for a religious epic with a strong moral message. Now it's a get-rich-quick game show. Not that it appeals to absolutely everyone, says psychiatrist Achal Bhagat.
You would not find
urban middle-class person from metropolitan city, especially a young person, 17, 18 years old, you wouldn't catch them dead watching this program. It is the suburbs, it is the smaller towns where the need to access opportunity is very high because they can see opportunity they cannot access. Here's a lifeline for accessing opportunity.
Amongst India's elite, the debate goes on, but most ordinary people are glued to the television, dreaming of making several million quick rupees. For The World, I'm Jill McGivering in Film City, Bombay.
Now, we need your final answer for today's Geo Quiz. We're searching for one of the oldest cities in Poland. It was the royal capital of the nation for half a millennium, and in spite of its riches, it survived World War II and communism relatively unscathed. Today, it is indisputably Poland's cultural capital. Okay, you've polled the audience, you've called a friend, you're out of lifelines. Is the correct answer A, Warsaw, B, Gdansk, C, Chicago, or D, Krakow? The answer is D, Krakow. Music from the National Orchestra that has no nation. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with the support of Merck, a research-driven pharmaceutical company discovering, developing, manufacturing, and marketing a broad range of human and animal health products and services. Merck, committed to bringing out the best in medicine. And by Red Band Broadcasting, bringing the next generation of news, talk, and entertainment to radio and the internet. On demand at redband.com.
This is The World. I'm Tony Khan. George W. Bush's search for a vice presidential candidate ended today when he offered the job to the man he had originally picked to find him a running mate. Former Defense Secretary Dick Cheney today confirmed that he has agreed to become the number two on the GOP's presidential ticket. Ennio Caretto, the Washington bureau chief for the Italian daily Corriere della Sera, says neither Bush nor Democratic nominee Al Gore have turned the Italian public on to this year's presidential race, and Dick Cheney's presence isn't going to change that.
Not many people know Cheney, and the election campaign has been quite boring to the Italian public. With all respect for Cheney, that I remember very well as a Secretary of Defense, he sounds to me that he is as great as Vice President Gore. And Mr. Bush could have chosen more exciting candidates such as General Colin Powell or a woman.
When will the election here in the United States get exciting for your readers of the Corriere della Sera?
Well, it depends. I think the readers will follow the campaign during the conventions, of course. It will depend on the dose of charisma that Bush or Gore will be able to exercise after September.
You know, one of the arguments is being made in favor of one candidate over another here in the States is that Mr. Gore has more experience with foreign affairs and that Mr. Cheney was picked by Mr. Bush because he had more experience in foreign affairs. When you get right down to it, do Italians really feel that that is an important consideration for them in terms of where they would like to be putting their money?
Well, the way we have looked at it is that the choice of Mr. Bush made is the choice of a man who is already a president, not a candidate. He has chosen somebody who would be akin to the prime minister in France for an interim period, a man of deep experience, great experience, who can be acting as president if needed during the transition time, immediately after the victory, if there is a victory of the Republican Party.
Now, that is interesting. You're saying that the Italians sort of intuit that what this means is that he is providing a good transitional figure to help ease the new Bush administration in after the Clinton administration goes.
That's right. That's a feeling, because Cheney has been a man of some power in Congress besides the government. He has worked in the White House, so he's a man who knows the Washington, he's a Washington insider, as they say in the United States, and he has a lot of international connections. So from the operational point of view of a new administration, the choice is very good.
So they're saying this is the behavior of a confident man.
Yes, exactly so. This is the behavior of a man who thinks he'll be elected on his own.
Ennio Caretto is the Washington, D.C. bureau chief for the Italian daily Corriere della Sera. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you to you. Bye-bye.